This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Let's talk about the birds and the bees and the butterflies and the beetles and other small members of the animal kingdom and their impact on our food supply. Did you know that those little guys are responsible for about one of every three bites of food we eat? But their numbers are dropping. And now the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden is working to reverse that trend with its Plant for Pollinators Challenge. The goal is to have more people growing pollinator-friendly plants. So let's talk about it with the Ohio State University Department of Entomology Assistant Professor and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs. Welcome, Joe.
Glad to be here.
Cincinnati Zoo Manager of Interpretive Exhibits, Visitor Research, Conservation Communications, and Fun, Shasta Bray. Welcome, Shasta.
Thank you. Hello.
And Zoo Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline. He also writes columns for Horticulture Magazine, Ohio Gardener Magazine, and the Garden Rant blog. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
We just eat up the entire segment with all of your titles. It's very hard to get to the meat of everything, but we appreciate you being here. And if you listening want to join in on the conversation about pollinators, their importance, and what you can do or what you are doing to help the situation, the number is 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll look for you there as well. Scott, let's start with you. What motivated the zoo to get behind this pollinator plant challenge?
Well, that's kind of interesting. We had a lot of things going on in various parts of the zoo that were involved with pollinators. We had beekeepers. We had our zoo's Best Plants for Pollinators program, which is a branded set of plants that came out of our plant trialing, which can be found at local retail garden centers that, you know, are good plants for pollinators. We had different things in education and here and there and conservation efforts across the world. And our CEO, Dave Jenneke, was like, how can we put all this together and combine it with the component of conservation here in the region. And, you know, this is something, you know, planning for pollinators is something any homeowner can do. And it just sort of came together.
Joe, how serious of a problem is the pollinator situation?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. We do have, of course, some challenges with European honeybees. And I want to stress that because those are non-natives. The nice thing about that, I know it sounds funny to say the nice thing, if you have one problem, it can forge discoveries of other positive things. And so, for example, what the zoo is doing and what others are doing is to help us to better understand those pollinators that were in the background to begin with. So where we might be seeing some drops in some, recognizing that others are very important. For example, I always kid with Scott about this. The second most important group of pollinators in the world in terms of insects are flies. And who knew? I mean, it was something that frankly sort of surprised me when I first read the research. So had we not had a problem, I think perhaps the research, the recognition wouldn't have risen about the importance of other groups of pollinators, even beyond insects, by the way.
Well, let's flies in a broader sense, not house flies, but the big class of flying insects that are known
Diptera.
Diptera family.
So it's still okay to swat a house fly if they get
it's okay.
Yeah.
It's
We're not harming the environment too much. That's good to hear. So let's just cover that for the listener so that we all understand what we're talking about. It's not just bees. Mm-hmm. What are pollinators?
Let's let the entomologists do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because plants produce nectar free of charge. You know, they can take the molecules that you find in carbon dioxide and water and rearrange them using energy from the sun. Of course, we call that photosynthesis, to turn that into sugar water, nectar. Now, that's actually a bribe to get other animals to do their bidding. And so one thing that they might do, for example, is to be involved in plant reproduction. You know, if you have plants that have male and female flowers on different plants, it's not easy for that pollen to move over from, you know, from the males to the females. So nectar is the bribe to move that about. And anything that does that is considered a pollinator. But we also have to kind of recognize something else, too, and that is they're there for the nectar. And so there's that correlation between this thing that plants produce for free and moving about pollen. In some cases, that's not what happens, though. In some cases, the insects are just there for the nectar, and there's no pollen at that particular moment, and so on and so forth. And there are defense strategies by certain plants. We call these extra floral nectaries, like, for example, if you look at cherries. That nectar that oozes out attracts ants, for example. It's not extra floral means it's not part of the flower. And then those ants in turn go after eastern tent caterpillar, for example, provide defenses to the plant. So when we think of pollinators, it opens up the door to all these other wonderful relationships between animals and plants.
But most times we're talking about bees, flies, and wasps, and butterflies, of course, too.
And beetles.
And beetles to some extent. Yeah. So those are the primary insect pollinators. In some parts of the world, bats do the work, not so much here. And hummingbirds, to a certain extent, do some pollination too, right?
Very important fact. Your publication has a hummingbird buzzing around there. So, it is recognizing, though, that there are a lot of animals involved. And that's important because, as you started with your question, okay, so what's happening with the dip in some? Well, thankfully, we have others, as long as we know how to support them. And that'll turn our show, I hope, into actually what we're going to talk about, the fine work that's happening at the zoo to support these.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's like all of the scariest little creatures out there in the world are the most important to our survival. So Shasta, you coordinate the Plant for Pollinators Challenge at the zoo. The goal is to create 500 gardens this year. So where do we stand now?
Yeah. So we launched the challenge on March 1st. And so within the first, I guess we're 6 weeks in now, we are over 160 gardens already registered. Nice. So we are about 33% towards our goal, which is fantastic. And what's happening right now is people are registering gardens that they've already had existing, which is great because that helps us sort of get a baseline, and then we can map those out using a Google map and see, right, so what parts of the region and the city in Cincinnati are doing a good job for pollinators right now, and then that's going to help us be able to see what pockets we really need to focus on in the future. And then moving forward, as people start putting in new gardens, that's where we're really trying to get those folks that maybe hadn't thought about it before to start and then also register those gardens so we can keep moving ahead.
Is there any data from the map yet, like which parts of the region could be doing a little better with this?
You know, I haven't looked at it that closely yet. When you look at the map right now, it just looks like a whole bunch of butterflies all over the place. So we'll have to dig deeper into that soon.
Well, tell us what a pollinator plant garden is. What plants and et cetera are featured in it?
Well, maybe Scott wants to take that one because horticulture has been really great in helping us pull together that list of the best plants.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically anything that produces flowers is a good start. Putting a lot of flowers out there, producing the pollen and nectar that bring in all these different insects, just fantastic. Some flowers and plants are better than others, so that's where our zoo's best plants for pollinators list comes in our pocket guide that's available wherever we go and also on our website. So those are good plants to get in there for flowers and nectar. Now, also what's important and actually equally important, maybe more important, Joe could tell you, but are the host plants. Mm-hmm. So these are the plants that caterpillars need to feed on. For the butterflies and moths, that group of insects. And, you know, some of that is very common. Milkweed all across, you know, the country, monarchs, we all know that. Some of it much, much less so. And this particular Joe could help with. But if you want to have pipevine swallowtail, which is a beautiful butterfly, you've got to have pipevine in your garden somewhere. Problem is it's a native plant that's not common in the wild, and nobody really grows it as an ornamental right now. So that's a plant we want to get people growing again to host those insects. Oak trees, fantastic host plants for a wide range of what families?
Lepidoptera, yeah, moths and butterflies.
Yeah.
So is the idea then to place a specific pollinator garden somewhere on your property, or can it be interweaved into your existing garden?
Yeah, I think it definitely could be interweaved into an existing garden, and that's a great way to start if you've already got something going. This pocket guide and the list of plants that we have on our website was specifically curated by Horticulture based on the decades of research they've put into what grows best in our region and actually serves pollinators best. So it's very Cincinnati-focused. And it's also to register your garden for the challenge can be very simple. We really want to encourage folks that haven't done anything before to get started. So you really just need to have at least one host plant and one nectar plant to be considered a garden. So it can be very, very small. It could be a window box or a couple of flower pots to get started. And then hopefully you continue to grow that year after year. And so we've got some, you know, more giant gardens that are already registered, you know, where it's thousands of square feet or bigger, and really all over the spectrum.
One of the good things about our list, the Zoo's Best Plants for Pollinators list, is that so many of the all of those plants really are good companions in a suburban garden.
Yeah.
So these are real plants that are available in nurseries. In fact, they're available at about 20 local retail garden centers around the city, and they're locally grown by two growers too. So these are plants that are easily obtained, easily grown, and fit in well with an ordinary garden. Now you can put in small prairies, and you can do other things, and those are awesome. But for the average homeowner or even apartment dweller with a balcony and in a container, this list of plants is a great starting point, and they all work well. They're easy.
You know, I need to, first of all, we have one of the best zoos in the world. I might be a little biased, you know, living in the area, but that's just a fact. You start with a horticultural component. Shasta mentioned the plant list developed there by Steve Foltz and Plant Places. You can go online, look up Plant Places. You can find trees and shrubs and other plants that do well here. Followed by, I always love the name, the Buzz Troop. Deb, yeah. You know, Deb Zurich involved with that. So we're watching this develop. And one thing, though, that when we talk about pollinator gardens, let's start thinking broad scope. You know, very often people think, well, I want to put a little butterfly garden over here. That's fine, a butterfly garden. But think of your whole landscape. And how this ties together is actually where I developed an interest in this. I do diagnostic walkabouts with green industry folks all over the place. One place is the zoo. Now, I look for plant problems, including pests. And several years ago, I noticed that every time we visited the zoo, it was just, I mean, I was just kind of tagging along, you know, looking in the back because I wasn't finding any pests. For an entomologist, that's not very good. That wasn't very, until I, you know, so what's going on here? The entire zoo is a pollinator garden. Let's start there. Many of these pollinators in the adult form are feeding on nectar, but their offspring can be predators and parasitoids to keep down pests. The zoo does no spraying, and it's not because, not entirely because of preserving pollinators. It's because they don't need to. There's been a lot of research done in the last 10 to 15 years that has clearly demonstrated that plant diversity, particularly flowering plants, leads to reduced pests, reduced need to use insecticides. So to me, that's a powerful connector. You really can have a twofer here. We're supporting pollinators, but we're also supporting a reduced need to use insecticides that, of course, can have an impact on pollinators.
Right.
If you're listening and you have a strategy to attract pollinators to your garden, or if you're a beekeeper of some sort, or if you're looking for tips on how to improve your situation to attract more pollinators to your neck of the woods, give us a call, 513-419-7100. We'll have more on the Pollinator Plant Challenge just ahead. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking today about an effort led by the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden to have more pollinator-friendly plants in our lives and what you can do to help. So we continue now with the Ohio State University Department of Entomology Assistant Professor and Ohio State Extension Agent for Hamilton County, Joe Boggs, Cincinnati Zoo Manager of Interpretive Exhibits, Visitor Research, Conservation Communications, and Fun, Shasta Bray, and Zoo Manager of Botanical Garden. Garden Outreach, Scott Berline. Call 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like to submit some comments or some questions. So we've got an email from Nancy, and she wants to know if anyone is teaching local nurseries and homeowners about the dangers of garden chemicals to pollinators.
Oh, yeah, that's a big topic throughout the whole green industry, and Joe can say more, but...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is a major... as a matter of fact, Extension is very involved in this, and I need to make sure everybody understands. Extension is in all three of our states. University of Kentucky is a land grant, Extension in Kentucky, and many of you have listened to Dave Kester on here over the years. Indiana the same way, and Ohio State the same way, Purdue with Indiana. But we all do what is called pesticide applicator training. So applicators need to be licensed, and this is very serious business, folks. They need to be tested. They are tested. And then they need to have so much training each year for recertification. So over the last 4 to 5 years, all three of the regulatory agencies in these three states have upped the ante on making sure we're teaching about protecting pollinators. So, for example, there's a very important category in Ohio called CORE. Every applicator has to have it. And Pollinator Gardens, Protecting Pollinators, counts for CORE. That's very powerful. So great question, and it's one that that we all handle in different ways.
513-419-7100 is the number. We have David on the line. Hey, David.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you?
I'm just fine. I was very interested in hearing about your program. And in fact, I've had a garden for many years, and I have a flower garden, and I grow some vegetables as well. But my question is, I had heard one of the people saying that you can register your garden online, and my question is, what is the website where I can register?
Shasta, you're the manager of fun. Tell them where to have fun on the web.
That's a great question. Thanks for asking. So definitely, if you go to CincinnatiZoo.org, and then you can do two things. You could just put in /plant-for-pollinators, or you could go to the gardens page and scroll down and find the little box. I think it has a pretty picture of a monarch perhaps, and says plant for pollinators, and that will take you to the website. And there we've got the form where you can register your garden, and also lots of wonderful tips and guidelines on how to get started and where to find the plants, and all of that. And the map of where gardens are.
And our list of partners, we should mention partners.
Yes.
We wanted this program to be bigger than just a zoo. So initially, our first meeting, our only meeting so far, was with potential partners. And we now have 35, 34.
Probably close to 40.
Which includes some really heavy hitters, you know, OSU Extension. Cincinnati Parks, I believe, is about to register. They haven't. That would be really good. Who else is on that list right now? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, so a variety of garden centers and landscapers that are really sort of jumping on board to help push forward the pollinator efforts, and Civic Garden Center. So, all of these folks are really helping us get the word out and promote that beyond just our zoo audiences.
And David, if that didn't help you enough, we'll make sure that there's a link on WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition section. And thanks for your call and your question. It's 513-419-7100 if you'd like to give us a call. Next up is Wes. Hey, Wes.
I'm a rancher. I don't own any space where I could have a garden. What can I do?
Okay.
If you have anywhere to put a container, that's a great start. Enough containers out there equal a garden. Mm-hmm. And one thing we meant to mention earlier and didn't is the importance of having flowers from the beginning of the season to the end. So that might be a great place to put some annuals in your container, a lantana that blooms and provides nectar pretty much from May on to October. So that's one option. And you can also reach out and volunteer at a lot of different community gardens and public gardens that have their gardens, and you can play a role in supporting that.
So, yeah, that's not unusual for a lot of us who live particularly in the more densely populated parts of the region in the downtown areas. So maybe a window box, is that sufficient in any way?
Absolutely.
What would you be able to put in a window box to attract pollinators? What's the ideal scenario there?
You know, it all depends on sun exposure, but, you know, there are small – you generally with window boxes, you want a smaller plant or one that drapes out. So you know, zinnias would be a good choice. Pentas would be a good choice in sun. Lantana is always a great plant for pollinators. For shade, it gets a little trickier because for some reason those flowers seem to be a little less attractive to bees. Bees seem like they want to be out in the sun for the most part. But we've had a certain series of begonias. The cocktail series really did a good job of attracting bees and pollinators, which was kind of a surprise for us.
And how about some of those herbs that we talked about before? And that's a great thing you can also benefit from as well.
Sort of. you know, if you plant parsley in a container or in your garden or dill, what fun you will have with pollinators. You may not ever cook with them. The minute you have parsley of any size growing in your garden, you will see caterpillars from the black swallowtail, and they'll just devour it. But it's so much fun, and that's how you get the butterflies. So some of these herbs, I'm trying to remember others. There's fennel, dill, parsley.
Yeah. Across the board. Lavender. Across the board. It's. Yeah. But, you know, I want to back up, though, on something, though, that has to do with this outreach and what people might do. First of all, the zoo has a wonderful volunteers program. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in becoming involved in this directly, the Buzz Troop is all volunteers. But you can get involved that way. But just visit the zoo and walk around. Start now and take notes. So walk around, take notes. Virtually every plant is labeled. That's the beauty. I mean, I know that now somebody will go there and find the one it isn't, but and say, well, call Scott and complain if you find it. But the point I'm making is that that you can learn so much. And, of course, our parks, too. Many of our parks, you mentioned Cincinnati Parks, for example, they also likewise are doing this. Great parks of Hamilton County, same thing. Visit places where plants are labeled and just observe. And see what's coming in. And if it's a small plant, you know, this is an annual in particular, wow, that's a window box plant.
I'll just throw it out there that Alt Park is not a bad place to visit right now.
Oh, that's
the
true.
The cherries are in full bloom, and it is spectacular. So
I may go there after the show.
I've been doing it the last few days on my way home from work.
What about wasps? Are wasps pollinators?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
But they're kind of scary, though.
They are scary until, you know, I've made this point. It seems like wasps are attracted to plants with very small flowers a lot of times. Yeah. So I've had these plants that, I'm trying to think of one right now, snowberry, little tiny flowers loaded with every kind of wasp and little fly and bee, all of them just hovering around it. And just as an experiment, I provoked them. I went in there, I was batting them, I was bothering them, I waving my arm in and around. And all they ever do is just fly away and go right back to another flower. When they're feeding, they have no interest in stinging anything. It's only when you get near their nests, or you step on in the grass because you're barefoot, and you shouldn't do that anyway.
That's right.
And or if you drink one in a can of soda, that you're in trouble. Most times wasps, you know, they're very beneficial. And you kind of get used to them after a while. They are fun insects.
Are they fun insects?
Well, here's something about, by the way, next time you do that, let me videotape it for YouTube, just in case it goes sideways. That could be. But here's something that's a little known fact about wasps and yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets, the three scaries, right? They have to feed their young meat. So while the immature wasps are growing up, these are going out and they're hunting down caterpillars. Well, sometimes they're good caterpillars, but many times they are what we call plant pests. And then this other group of plant pests we find, particularly on conifers, sawflies. So all three of those, they're all wasps. So bald-faced hornets, paper wasps, yellow jackets. They're out there gathering meat, which once again goes back to reduce pests. And of the three, paper wasps are a tremendous pollinator. You very seldom find, for example, some of our flowering trees. You don't find paper wasps. So One thing that the zoo is working hard to do, and we're all working hard to do, is to help people to recognize all these different pollinators to reduce the fear factor. Mm-hmm.
But in the eyes of a wasp, am I meat?
No. Scott's wanting
I'm trying to find the answer to that, and I'm just not.
we want so much to say yes, yeah. Just to see you running. But no.
Here's the thing, because this is the season for wasp real estate, right? I mean, they're building up
their
nest.
Good point.
What are you supposed to do when you see one in the corner of your home or your apartment building? I mean, when do you take a shot at them?
Well, and to be realistic, we do want to back up. There are individuals that are, deathly allergic to the venom. So we need to recognize that. Despite everything we say, to say, hello to the wasps in the morning may not be a great thing to do. But Scott said something that is extremely important. They're not aggressive out flying around because they're not defending their territory. They're not defending nests. But if you do have a nest, which you're right, Michael, they're developing right now, the overwintering queens are starting new nests. It's amazing how fast, they go from just a little tiny thing to a big bald-faced hornet's nest, same with the yellow jackets. But they won't become very aggressive until you start getting close to that nest. Now, if you do have one and you are allergic, obviously, we would hope you would get, some help with that and don't do it yourself. There's a lot of times that people will try that. Usually ends badly, can end very badly. So we're not saying, okay, don't kill wasps. We're saying, though, let's recognize they have a very important role and don't go out of your way.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Tracy on the line. Hey, Tracy.
Hi. I had a question. I'm a member of the Cincinnati Nature Center, and they have a big focus on planting native. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, I'm thinking about doing a pollinator garden, but I was wondering if the list of plants, does it focus on native species or more on exotic flowering plants?
All right, Tracy, we'll hang up and let the panel listen. Thanks for the call.
So our goal when developing this list was basically what would the average homeowner, average gardener want to plant and what works really well. So the vast majority, no, I won't say that, about half and half, or half are native, half are exotic. And the exotics that are on our list are not invasive. They grow really well here. They produce good quantities of nectar and pollen for insects. Where it really becomes important whether a plant is native or not is when it comes down to host plants. Mm-hmm. Because if it's a native insect, it probably needs a native host plant. And so that is the real true reason to plant more natives in your garden. And that could be anything from grasses and sedges, which act as host plants, all the way up to oak trees, to pawpaws and spice bush, which bring in the spice bush swallowtail and zebra swallowtails. So we want to make it easy for people to get started. The one interesting thing I think I've found with gardening is when people get started in gardening, they don't really know that much whether it's native, exotic. They don't think about it that much. But as any gardener starts, whatever got them started is, generally speaking, they become more native oriented as they progress and get more native plants in their gardens as they mature and learn more and become more informed. So just by getting people started, we think that, when they stay with it, we're going to see more native plants down the road. And that's important.
We spoke earlier about creating these in small spaces, and we got an email from Robert who says he's got an eighth of an acre. Wow. And has a bee and hummingbird garden in front and edible garden in the back, all in that little space. So I guess it can be done. Hummingbirds. Hummingbirds are another animal I don't trust. They're like,
what?
Come on.
They're like part bird, part bug. I don't know what's going on. But a lot of people seem to love these
things.
And
they can scare you if they come buzzing up.
They buzz
really
so
can
fast.
Be, yeah, they're kind of fun.
But then they're not going to sting you.
Well, I know they're not.
Right.
My parents love these little guys. They love sugar water, right? If you want to track those, they love sugar water.
They do.
So we have
do.
That in common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about beetles as well. I mean, beetles seem like unattractive bugs that you don't want around, but you do in some cases.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, and of course, I want to just, I like to see people plant natives to learn about natives, but there is a misconception that the nectar on natives is different than the nectar on those that that come from Europe, for example, and that's just simply not true. So plant what works well. But as an example, we have they're called soldier wing beetles, and you can find them on linden. You can find them on Katsura. And, of course, you know, we do have some native lindens. Katsura is not native. But and they are wonderful pollinators. But you're right. They look like beetles. On the other hand, their larvae, their immatures, feed on insects in the soil. So, for example, if you have a problem with cutworms in the soil, if you have a problem with rootworms, well, cutworms will come up out of the soil. Rootworms, that's a predator. I keep going back to this. It seems like a – but that is a beetle predator that's also a pollinator. And I do want to revisit something because this was something that was a surprise to me. So you mentioned not killing house flies, but green bottle flies are not a real pleasant fly when you think about what their maggots do.
Mm-hmm.
However, they are a very important pollinator.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I thought that they were just photobombing my images a few years ago. I thought, oh, this is terrible. They get rid of that fly, including at the zoo with mountain mint. They love mountain mint. Mm. But they are important pollinators. So understanding that helped to expand your mind with pollinators, I think, is a very important point.
The Plant for Pollinators Challenge will have details at WVXU.org. It's a worthy cause, but I recently watched Planet Earth on Netflix. I'm terrified to leave the house, so I'm not going to be helping at all. Thanks to Joe Boggs, Shasta Bray, and Scott Berline for being here today to talk about these things.
Thank you so much. You've been listening
to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Find archives at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.